So let's talk about left-right politics again, and hopefully for the last time. But I want to hammer this point home, just because this particular issue, it just seems to be the never-ending inhibitor of idea exchange in the men's movement. And I think this is only so because this binary functions to entrap, or perhaps the correct word is to entrance, the general public and those individuals too lazy to investigate deeper into the inner workings of society at large. This modern-day binary of the ignorant, as I like to call it, permeates and infiltrates everything it touches by default. It renders any free-flowing exchange of ideas futile. It's a self-perpetuating loop protocol designed to obfuscate, divert, and derail any given topic at hand. And I'm going to give you my assessments in regards to how this binary operates. Now, of course, the perfect examples are going to be the two American political parties. These two political parties, the right and left, function to corral consensus. They absorb and eventually corrupt all inventive and ingenuitive political thought. It was, I believe, Edward Bernays who said in his excellent book, Propaganda, that, quote, "The systemic study of mass psychology revealed to the students the potentialities of invisible government of society by manipulation of the motives which actuate men in the group." Trotter and Laban, who approached this subject in a scientific manner, and Graham Wallace and Walter Lippmann and others, who continued with searching studies of the group mind, established that the group has mental characteristics distinct from those of the individual, and is motivated by impulses and emotions which cannot be explained on the basis of what we know of individual psychology. So the question naturally arose, if we understand the mechanism and motives of the group mind, is it not possible to control and regiment the masses according to our will without their knowing about it? Now, this may sound conspiratorial, but in actuality, it just highlights what I've been positing video after video repeatedly, and that is organic explanations which unfold naturally. That politicians and advertising agencies naturally exploit. There are no nefarious cabals, just social trends and competing entities willing to capitalize on them. Truly, I hate to bring him up, but people like Bernard Chapin really are the archetypical manifestations of how this phenomenon occurs, in this case on the right-hand side of the political equation. And honestly, I really would like to leave him in his little left-right, good versus evil, apocalyptic struggle he imagines himself to be in, but he's just too good of an example not to use him as a descriptor in this video. And I know you guys are sick of hearing about him, so just please bear with me. But for a second, let's go back to left and right. The difference between the right and the left really isn't much of a difference at all. It's all surface level, really. Both have their othering terms. You have leftist, collectivist, Marxist on the right. You have racist, misogynist, bigot on the left. Both play to their constituency, promising them what they want to hear and never actually delivering. Both eventually blame their inability to deliver on the other political party. The difference is certainly not whether one or the other is more exploitative, but in how they exploit, and how they exploit men in particular. Now, let's do a little thought experiment. Let's imagine that the left just disappeared completely. In an instant, poof, the left is gone. What would that look like? Well, we'd still have crony capitalism. We'd still have out-of-control military spending that exploded during the Bush era. We'd still have big government. We'd still have the war on drugs. Excess spending in a world without the left would just be funneled to this, not back into the taxpayer's wallet. And in the interim, and this is the interesting part, not only would spending be funneled into these traditionally right-wing war on terror expenditures, but a spending vacuum would have formed which would be followed by the right-wing politicians left over fighting and competing for the tax dollars the left would have previously spent. They would do so by continuing the left's entitlements in one form or another, till eventually they would become the new left-wing. Because you see, politicians, wherever they align themselves on the political spectrum, are there to convince the people that they're serving their interests, and in the process secure as much money for themselves and their districts as possible while they're doing it. Government isn't here to limit itself because libertarians want it to, and it's not here to grow because leftists say so. It's here to grow because that's what it does. Simple as that. The rest are just details on how to convince the general public that they exist to serve instead of control. They're allowed to do this because they provide certain services that simply would not and could not exist in a severely limited or even non-governmental setup that the libertarians and anarcho-capitalists naively, in my opinion, propose as the solution to the inherently oppressive state. And it is inherently oppressive, without a doubt. And we're going to address some of these flaws that would present themselves in Ancapistan, I'll call it, which is a hypothetical anarcho-capitalist country. We'll address those in a bit, but for now, Let's just go back to left and right. One of the more dishonest tactics of the defeat the left conspiracy theorist is to assume that every manifestation of socialism observed in society is proof of the blame it all on Karl Marx conspiracy world they see themselves in. Socialism is in fact a manifestation of inherent human drives much more often than not. So if we explore socialism and capitalism as natural human behaviors, we'll see that socialism is as much a result of the human condition as capitalism is, and certainly more than just learned behavior. In the supposed free market Republic of America, we like to tell ourselves that we have certain inalienable rights. Now, I don't believe rights tangibly exist, but let's assume for the purposes of this example that they do. We believe, then, that we have inalienable rights that a voting majority cannot deprive us of. The evidence, however, tells us something completely different. If we look at the events that unfolded in the years immediately following 9/11, that pretty little illusion was conclusively shattered to dust, because what followed 9/11 was an American public both on the right and left that tolerated and even voted for legislations that completely disregarded fundamental basic human rights and liberties. We had the Patriot Act, we had extraordinary rendition. Now, more recently with the Obama administration, we have drone strike kill lists. This is happening on both sides of the political spectrum, all under the guise of keeping the majority safe. And we see the same with things like Sandy Hook and gun rights. Human beings will gladly throw away these so-called rights and liberties if they perceive their safety to be in jeopardy. If you tell them it's for the safety of the children, if you tell them it's to stop terrorism, if you can get them to genuinely believe that, they will vote any of these so-called inalienable rights out of existence. If, for example, 20 Sandy Hooks happen consecutively from today onward, one day after another, the Second Amendment would be gone, de-ratified completely within the year. And for what? Well, for the safety of the collective, for the safety of the children. I believe it was Henry Kissinger who said it best when he said, quote, "Today, Americans would be outraged if UN troops entered Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow, they will be grateful. This is especially true if they were told that there was an outside threat from beyond, whether real or promulgated, that threatened our very existence." That is socialism, in the purest sense, and unfortunately it's hardwired behavior that's extremely difficult to resist. Protect the tribe at all cost, and what are nations if not nothing more than large tribes? And any government intent on disarming its citizenry would never start by waltzing into people's homes and confiscating their weapons. You see, first, you need a bunch of right-wing fools to tell you that terrorists want to kill you, a bunch of left-wing idiots to tell you that gun rights kill children, and that's how people like Bernard Chapin ended up supporting the Iraq War, which he admits to, supporting the expenditure of trillions of tax dollars so that a nationalized socialist military force could go bomb people in the Middle East. That is socialism. But of course, he can't blame this on leftists, because someone like Chapin, who, according to him, this is one of his favorite little lines, who studies politics and knows what he's talking about, couldn't possibly be tricked into emulating his own version of leftist collectivism. So when the Iraq War became the disaster that it was, and when all we had to show for it was dead Americans and dead Iraqis and a $1 trillion bill, then, and this is standard operating procedure for the right-wing hypocrite, then he switched his message conveniently to, you know, I made a mistake in supporting the Iraq War. And I'm not sticking up for leftists here. Keep in mind that we're discussing mirror images of each other. But you see, when leftists support collectivism, it's a Marxist agenda. When right-wing types like him do it, it's a mistake. To the Bernard Chapins of the world and the others like him, I point out the following inconsistencies in their rhetoric. I start by asking the question, did I support or agree with the Iraq War? No, I didn't. I wasn't sufficiently convinced back then or today that terrorism posed a significant enough threat to myself or the United States to justify a war that, barring World War II, has become the most expensive military endeavor in American history. More importantly, I considered the cost of human life that would inevitably result from these Middle Eastern wars unacceptable. I also considered these wars to be an example of male disposability in this purest sense. So back then to my original point. Did I support the Iraq War? No. Did I get to opt out of paying taxes to support it? No. Taxes were forcefully deducted from my earnings to fund this. You, Bernard Chapin, supported this war. Now you call it a mistake. Very convenient. But you supported it nonetheless, meaning that you supported my tax dollars being involuntarily taken from me to support what I imagined you rationalized at the time as being necessary for the protection of America. I ask you then, How is that any different from a feminist whom supports taxing the general public for, say, I don't know, women-only domestic violence shelters? Again, I don't support this, and yet my tax dollars are forcefully requisitioned for these purposes. She can justify it, just like you did, by mentioning some nonsense about women being at a higher risk than the general public for being victims of domestic violence. Just like you justified your decision by saying it's for the safety of the American people. In either case, the evidence simply doesn't bear that out. Even if the evidence did support either of these claims, it doesn't take away the fact that both are collectivist socialist measures, one of which you undeniably supported by your own admission. People like Bernard Chapin are, by their very own actions, the collectivists they claim to hate. And they're so blinded by this left-right nonsense that they've effectively double-think their way into ignoring all the statism that goes on within the right. Instead of admitting this, he pathetically labels it a mistake. And to that I say, would the domestic violence for women tax dollars only feminist I mentioned earlier be able to get away with saying to any MRA at all, sure, I supported this, but it was a mistake. But the right is still far worse, so we should still vote for Obama. The lesser of two evils and all that. Could she get away with that? You see, that's what the brainwashed right-winger stereotype generally does. Watch how this works, and Chapin in particular is quite fond of this little deflection. If you say, for example, supporting candidates up to and including presidential candidates which support funding for Israel, the drug war, or any other of these various right-wing sacred cows, the right-winger in question will say, well, I don't support that. That's not what I believe in. I'm just voting for conservative candidates that do support that because the alternative, Obama, is far, far worse, which we'll come back to in a second. But notice how they allow themselves this luxury when making their arguments, that luxury being the negation of tacit approval of all the actions a politician they vote for taking effect. But a liberal who votes for Obama, claiming to only do it because he sees the right wing as always being the worst of the two evils, this liberal supports feminism by default if he voted for Obama. And rightly so. The reason being that Obama's support of feminism is so odious that one can't possibly get away with giving him his vote without tacitly approving of feminism. Apply this logic to a conservative and to them, according to them, tacit approval for foreign aid to First World Israel suddenly magically doesn't apply. And I want to specify that what I'm doing here is subjecting people like Bernard Chapin to the exact same standards they subject leftists to. It's the lesser of two evils doctrine of this little cult that they selectively enforce to their own advantage. So I'll repeat my point once again. If we can define collectivism, even partially, as either supporting or directly participating in the forcible taxation of individuals for the benefit of some collective group, then Chapin's support of the government taxing me against my will for a war he supported is in fact collectivism, by his own definition of the term. And frankly, I believe that if another war in the Middle East were to start tomorrow and he thought as he did last time that it was for the greater good of national security or whatever he used to rationalize it, Chapin and others like him would once again drop this little libertarian facade they wear and show their true neocon big government colors by voting for whichever politician told them they'll keep America safe or whatever it is they wanted to hear. But back to the lesser of two evils doctrine endemic to this right-left religion. Now, Chapin is confirmed as voting for John McCain, a man who supports sending men to war in the Middle East, whilst sitting comfortably in a chair in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee and lambasting those same men who go to war in part under his influence for a so-called epidemic of sexual assault against women to a degree that he cannot, in good conscience, recommend women join the military. And this is who Bernard Chapin deemed fitting for the job of U.S. president. He rationalized it, of course, by saying to himself, well, if Obama is the only other choice, I may as well support McCain because only Obama supports things like men are inherently bad, women are inherently victim political narratives. Then McCain, surprise, surprise, turns out to support men are inherently evil, women are inherently victim narratives. And then it's a mistake again, you see? Chapin, who claims to have such a robust knowledge of the mechanics of politics, tricked by a politician who, and I know this is unheard of for politicians to do, lied about an anti-collectivist position because he knew suckers like Chapin wanted to hear that nonsense. And the truth is that McCain didn't even quite lie about it. You see, most of the times, politicians, if you know what to listen for, have a little habit of nestling exactly what it is they intend to do in their words as opposed to the lies they feed the public. You just have to know what to listen for. The science of politics is, of course, the art of carefully hidden plausible deniability. But it wasn't McCain who tricked people like Chapin and others like him. It was actually Chapin and people like him who serially tricked themselves election after election, blindly making their way to the voting booth to participate in what can increasingly be described as nothing other than a bread and circus show, or reality TV for those that use their self-ordained political superiority to escape their own shortcoming. It's these people who tricked themselves into this glorified game of cowboys and Indians, left versus right, my team is better than yours, over and over, and politicians capitalize off of this need to join a political team, this stubborn adherence to right or left, to such a degree that they've been successfully getting both sides to support policies they claim to be endemically against for decades now. We hear a lot of talk about government being incompetent, politicians being buffoons and idiots, but the politicians are actually the smarter ones in this equation, and I emphasize the word smarter, because honestly now, it doesn't take that much intelligence to convince dullards like Chapin on both the right and left wing of the political discourse when you're banking on this team red-blue lesser of two evils mentality to guarantee your vote. To a degree, this phenomena is about feeling superior. This is the Alex Jones, we know the one true solution to politics and all the rest of you are just dumb sheeple, wake up nonsense. It's the political version of the nonconformist goth types conforming rigidly to their own goth culture, never realizing how conformist they actually are. And yes, it really is that childish. People like Chapin are the right-wing versions of the granola-eating hippie liberal smugly reciting some little hippie talking points about the evils of the right-wing whatever. And Chapin and his ilk are the mirror images of this, and they're so stuck in this brainwashed political ideology that they couldn't possibly self-analyze long enough to see it. Now, from the outside looking in, if you truly look at the McCarthy-esque way they talk about leftism, it has all the hallmarks of a religion from which the adherents derive a false sense of superiority. God's chosen people, if you will, fighting the good fight against the great Satan of leftism. Because whenever there exists a great Satan to vanquish, there will exist convenient idiots and zealots willing to join in the cause of fighting it. And this great Satan need not be real for the zealots to align themselves against it. It can very well be imagined, and in this case it most certainly is imagined, and in fact, it is actually preferable to a tangible evil force. A real threat, after all, can in fact be vanquished, eliminated, done away with. But a fake threat, the threat of a world under constant attack by leftism, the definition of which is constantly shifted by design by these people, so as to avoid scrutiny, provides to the defeat the left crusader an inexhaustible supply of threat, an inexhaustible supply of intellectual and moral superiority they can adorn themselves with, and an inexhaustible amount of excuses to look over their political-sized politicians' failure to earn their votes. Now, one of the main points that I want to debunk here is the claim that it was all the left conspiracy theorists used to prop up their Marxism single-handedly is destroying the West baloney. I want to one by one destroy all of their shibboleth with practical solutions grounded in sociodynamics and not ridiculous conspiracies about Fabian socialism or globalist or, you know, whatever's in vogue at the moment. One of Man and Woman Myth's most recent videos, which I forget the title to now, but I'll put it in the description box, said it best, I think. He said, and I'm paraphrasing heavily here, women are never going to withdraw support for the state. The state is never going to stop supporting them. The only actual possibility for change is for men to change. And even that's a long shot, considering that we still have men defending the criminal contract of marriage, even when they know the potentially devastating risk inherent to the entire institution. Now let's ask ourselves this. If it was women inheriting the risks of the marriage contract, would they? Would they, in your estimations, take these risks for men to the degree that men do for women? To all married men, or better yet instead, I direct this question to those married men that insist on prescribing marriage to impressionable men in any context that retains the potential legal pitfalls involved. Are you prepared to honestly say that if your wife had to shoulder the burden of the risks associated with marriage that you shouldered for her, would she? The vast majority of you who say yes should have a very hard time keeping a straight face while doing it, if you're being honest with yourself. Watch my video titled A Response to Becoming Ambient for a proper breakdown of what feminism actually is. It's nonstop female advocacy. I've said this tons of times before. It's nonstop female advocacy that doesn't care who it exploits as long as that end is achieved. So before we address identity politics, let's talk again briefly about the likelihood of recruiting large amounts of women to our cause. Now, the difficulty arises on multiple fronts. As we all know, Humans are heavily influenced by incentives. Where there exists no incentive for a mass behavioral change, a population will not engage in those behaviors. If incentives do exist, they have to be more compelling than the incentives for inaction. The problem with recruiting women into the men's rights movement is that there isn't enough incentive present, and there probably won't be until things have gotten so bad that women themselves will no longer be able to deny what a huge burden they are to society. And yes, they are a massive burden on society. Everything that men do on their own, women require massive accommodations to do the same. I'm not even going to waste my time citing the robust list of examples that make up the massive social and governmental pumping operation that is the bend over backwards to make women feel comfortable in a man's world mentality. I could do that, but that would comprise an entire new video. Back to incentive. The problem is as follows. Women generally look inwards. Unfortunately, they seem on the macro scale to be unable to comprehend anything outside of the self. If you need proof of this, look at the fact that it never occurs to most women that squeezing men out of college campuses using affirmative action is not only going to cause immense damage to men, but will shrink the pool of men that they find financially suitable as a mate. In response to this, what do we see more of? Answer me this. And I mean vastly more of. Do we see more women blithely talking about the lack of good men, talking about how we're stuck in perpetual adolescence? Or do you see more women putting it together logically, saying that forcing more men out of a chance for education in order to make room for a disproportionate amount of leg up for women will inevitably result in less of what they deem as good men? It's this propensity for this inwardly obsessed lack of foresight, this blatant disregard of the universal laws of actions and reactions that functions as proof positive that women cannot be trusted in the aggregate to make reasonable decisions in regards to the welfare of a sustainable civilization. I talked about my previous video about prostitution, about how legalization and destigmatization operates as the locks on the floodgates that catalyze social change surrounding taboo behaviors. The propensity towards the self that has been observed with women throughout history naturally gave rise to taboos surrounding entrusting women to positions of authority. What we did wrong in granting women the vote is that we still coddled them, we still shielded them from the harsh realities of the vote, and then a few decades later, when women became emboldened enough to start a sexual revolution, we allowed them to destigmatize their own self-absorbed infantilism. And what we're left with are children in adult bodies that know they have sexual power and know how to use it, who now also have the ability to vote and are going to do so in a way that you would expect children to. It's like giving a child the right to vote to spend all of daddy's money on fudgesicles when a child can't even conceptualize what an honest day's work is. Now, I'm not saying women shouldn't be able to vote. I'm saying that allowing women to vote while shielding them from harsh realities is a recipe for disaster, in accordance with the extensive documentation of the inherent proclivity the female has towards her own security. We shield women from risk, we pretend they don't have a natural proclivity towards an obsession with their own security and safety, give them the vote, and then whine about identity politics when they do exactly what one should expect them to do. That is, vote in their own self-interest to the point where they don't care if it affects anybody else negatively. And then we perpetuate the problem further by finding all manner of conspiracy theory, Marxism, socialism, the elites, the globalists, whatever, to further shield women from the direct consequences of their actions. Now, I imagine that if and when society collapses, one has to wonder whether or not we'll be blaming the Rockefellers or the Bilderbergers instead of the massive burden that women put on the productive taxpayer because they couldn't satiate themselves no matter how much men bent over backwards to engineer society to their specifications. Identity politics, when used by the it-was-all-the-left crusader, is a toolbox term designed to lend credence to this overarching conspiracy they parrot. Now, the fact that people are naturally tribalistic, naturally selfish, naturally self-absorbed is a simple explanation for identity politics. Men vote for less government intervention in general because they too practice a form of identity politics themselves. We know that we generally do better than women do with less government interference in our lives. Women do better with government safety nets, as many as possible, and it's certainly no surprise or conspiracy that they vote as such. Now, with all that said, let's go back to the anarcho-capitalist, the Ancapistan fictional world that we talked about earlier. My problem with anarcho-capitalists, and I don't think that it's a horrible idea per se. I just think that we haven't been given any kind of reasonable path towards removing the state. I just don't see it happening. Now let me talk about some of the problems that may arise in an anarcho-capitalist setup. Many anarcho-capitalists advocate for, let's say, a completely voluntary form of law enforcement, where free market forces are applied to various for-profit protection agencies. Now, I believe that this can't work because it suppresses a fundamental human element in play here. And that's the tendency to want to perceive authority in one uniform force. Now, the Milgram experiments, for example, show us that average everyday people are willing to deliver lethal electric shocks to other human beings so long as a man in a doctor's uniform stands over them officiating. The general public has a natural tendency to defer to systems of authority, and this is even more prevalent in democracies where they can rest comfortably in the illusion that the police and government exist to serve them. So, one of the many problems I see with having for-profit police agencies, for example, in Ancapistan is as follows. Let's say you have a for-profit protection agency, and their business is to resolve matters ranging from petty theft to murder. For-profit security agency A receives a call from Bill stating that John broke into his house and stole $1,000. John vehemently denies this, and in a free market system of for-profit security agencies, calls up security agency B and asks for protection from agency A. And from this point, one of two scenarios can unfold. Both security agencies can engage in a violent confrontation with each other, agency A initiating violence to reclaim Bill's stolen property, and agency B retaliating with violence to defend John's alleged innocence. Since human beings tend to want to avoid violence, the second scenario that can unfold is that agency A and B can defer to a for-profit judge to mediate this dispute. Now, this judge may very well be a part of a conglomerate of for-profit judges competing with other conglomerates of for-profit judges, forming an industry of for-profit judges that serve an industry of for-profit police agencies. And if that happens, what you now have is essentially competing factions of law enforcement agencies vying for as much money from the people as possible. This is de facto government, bound to form as many crippling bureaucracies as our present form of government, perhaps even more, with a financial incentive to make as much money as possible, just like our current form of government. And the only major difference I can see unfolding from what we have now is the added feature of lacking a cohesive, centralized force that all people recognize as the universal police force. This will inevitably cause large amounts of civil conflict that these competing for-profit agencies will exploit for financial gain until one agency wins out, and we're stuck with something resembling almost exactly what our government police force does today. The fact is that people in general will want to default to a central law enforcement authority so they can get on with their lives and do whatever it is they wish to do. They certainly would like to avoid buying protection from competing companies and are more than happy to just agree, in the most part, to deposit a certain amount of their earnings into a unified, universally recognizable police force. It's generally a matter of convenience for them. And this isn't right or wrong, but simply what is most likely to occur. Now, sure, some folks are going to say, well, I didn't consent to this police force, and I sure don't consent to my earnings being taxed to sustain it. But that's simply the way it is, and the vast majority of people aren't going to want to buy policing services like they do their auto insurance. This is one of the ways that, quote, collectivism manifests itself naturally within society. This is what people need to start understanding, instead of blaming the ghost of Karl Marx every time human beings exhibit for the greater good of the tribe behavior. I make no moral assessment of these naturally socialistic tendencies. I certainly don't enjoy paying the taxes for them, and the potential for abuse of this phenomena undoubtedly exists, but it doesn't change the fact that this is what human beings tend toward in certain situations. Now, if we look at auto insurance as well, we can also draw some parallels between something we see in practice in the real world as compared to what we're theorizing could work in an anarcho-capitalist setup. Now, we pay car insurance to ensure that if we get into a car accident, medical bills will be paid, damages will be paid, and most accidents are resolved to an acceptable degree to society at large. In a completely free market society, however, many people will of course choose to opt out of car insurance. Now, what happens to a man or woman that crashes into another person, causing that person severe physical damage requiring extensive medical care, as well as damage to both of the vehicles? How is the victim of the accident supposed to recoup money for medical care and damage to his vehicle when the person who caused it in the accident has no insurance and no money to pay for it himself? Do we force the person who caused the accident to work in some sort of debtor's prison to pay off this debt? If so, who forces him? There's no government, remember? In a world without government, I suppose there would be a high likelihood that some private policing agency would arrest this individual and force him to work off his debt to the person he crashed into, since a world without government could not exact laws against debtors' imprisonment. And if this person couldn't afford to hire his own security agency to defend him from debtors' prison, well, you know, tough luck, I guess. So this could also lead to insurance agencies factoring in the cost of voluntarily uninsured drivers into your insurance bill, which I'm sure is already done today to some degree. But the amount of drivers today without insurance is kept to a minimum by enforcing a government-mandated auto insurance contract on the people. Again, I make no moral judgment on this. I'm simply explaining the facts. Without this compulsory contract, how will they calculate this risk? And trust me, they will attempt to calculate it, since insurance companies want to minimize risk and maximize profit. So how will they calculate it? Well, I'd imagine that these insurance agencies would set up some sort of system by which their clients will have to submit to some sort of insurance verification process to drive in certain high-risk areas where non-insured driver accidents are prevalent. And without government, all of these roads will now be owned by private interests instead of government. So every road you drive on could potentially have different requisites for access to them. It quickly becomes apparent that it's simply much more practical and efficient to have a governing authority that makes it illegal to drive without insurance, and the ethics of this never even comes into the equation, just the practicality. When structuring a civilization, ethics comes into the picture only when ignoring them poses grievous infringement on the lives and well-being of the people within this society. Another question is, how would a Second Amendment function in an anarcho-capitalist state? Now, the right to bear arms creates another clear example of how most people are more than happy to tolerate socialist measures to varying degrees for the benefit of the collective. In an anarcho-capitalist society where no government exists, anybody can defend themselves any way they wish. This means that so long as someone is not using it offensively to deprive others of their freedoms, one could essentially say, I wish to stockpile aerosolized anthrax and landmines and rocket launchers for my own personal defense. And perhaps some exceedingly wealthy venture capitalist types will want to be able to afford a nuclear weapon for their own protection. A Bill Gates or a Warren Buffett could do so easily if he wished to. But no society is going to be comfortable allowing these things, because it only takes one person stockpiling anthrax or rocket launchers or even a nuclear warhead to simply say that they'll only use it for self-defense and then use them to cause mass death and destruction. You see, we readily violate the non-aggression principle in this case and say to ourselves, your right to defend yourself, however you see fit, takes a backseat to our collective safety. And so we will restrict your right to defend yourself to the use of self-defense items that do not pose such a catastrophic risk to the general public, should you choose to use these weapons for unprovoked violence against others. This is collectivism. Compulsory emergency medical care is collectivism. The vast majority of people will agree to violating the non-aggression principle by using the government to forcibly coerce for-profit hospitals to provide care to people who are in danger of dying, even if they don't want to. In an anarcho-capitalist setup, these hospitals should be allowed to let anyone they didn't want to treat for any reason die in the streets. They should be able to withhold emergency medical care to absolutely anyone. The general public, once again, is perfectly fine allowing this form of collectivism to persist. And it's just not in our nature not to, as human beings. Just like we have socialist tendencies, we of course have capitalistic tendencies which should be encouraged. Nothing quite electrifies the hearts of men as the chance to earn himself a pass out of poverty by the fruit of his own labor, to the degree that he can within a socialist construct, which is what civilization is, an artificial construct designed to distribute wealth via taxation. And since civilization is not possible without taxation, what civilization does, well, what a successful capitalistic civilization does, is to incentivize the portion of human nature that lends itself to capitalism in order to generate the revenue necessary to afford certain socialist luxuries. Capitalism will by default create winners and losers. Some will succeed, some will fail, and many will fail for a variety of different reasons. Now, you may have two competitors competing for a given market in a given area. Let's say organic farmers with small businesses capable of supplying the town they live in with their organic food product. Now, these two business owners are in direct competition with each other and will compete with each other until one or the other goes out of business. Let's just say that it's in the nature of both of these businessmen to compete to that extreme. Let's then assume that these two businessmen are of equal intelligence in terms of their capacity to devise inventive techniques which allow them to provide their products at a cheaper cost without sacrificing quality. Now, in this hypothetical scenario, it may very well eventually be simple luck, a roll of the dice that decides who wins out. We can assume that these businessmen live on opposite ends of towns, and a swarm of insects or some other crop-eating pest might destroy Farmer B's yearly crop and leave the other Farmer A's farm alone. Businessman A wins out. Businessman B loses his business and his job. Now, in a purely capitalistic society, assuming businessman B somehow lost all of his savings in the collapse of his business and has no family he can rely on, and let's also say that businessman B even went into debt in the process and has no means of paying it back, businessman B is essentially kind of screwed. In an anarcho-capitalist society, whatever loan agency lent him money should theoretically be allowed to forcefully compel businessman B to pay off his debts, up to and including subjecting him to forced labor. Instead, what we do is to allow him to file bankruptcy, which is a form of debt forgiveness that only allows the lender to collect a partial amount of money they lent out, because the alternative is perhaps decades of paying off a debt for businessman B, who is a person that could potentially, if allowed to skirt this debt, go on to create a thriving business in which luck may favor him the second time around. Why do we do this? Well, because in many respects, we are socialist creatures, and as much as we hate being taxed, the fact is that the vast majority of people would rather live in a society where government collects taxes and provides certain services to them, whether or not libertarians or even anarcho-capitalists think it to be moral or in violation of so-called inalienable rights, or in violation of a non-aggression principle that has never existed in nature and has been serially violated time and time again in every epoch of human history up until the present. All taxes are by definition a form of socialism. We often hear that taxation is theft. And perhaps it is. More importantly, taxation is a form of theft that the vast majority of people throughout history and up to present day acquiesce to. Taxes have been with us since the development of the city-state, perhaps even before. Our species naturally seeks out the greater good. It's a testament to our nomadic tribal ancestry where everyone is expected to pitch in for the betterment of the group or tribe, whether they like to or not. The tribe was paramount over the individual for the majority of our species' existence. Before we erected civilization, which is essentially a massive safety net for all those living within that civilization, it was of paramount importance that one adhered to the interests of the tribe. One couldn't survive without the tribe, after all. And this is the genesis of our socialist instinct, and not some manifesto written in the 1900s or whatever. So, in assessing what an anarcho-capitalist world might look like, unless I hear some sort of reasonable example of an anarcho-capitalist state devoid of these problems, and many others that could spring up that I haven't yet mentioned, I resign myself to a limited government stance in which I acknowledge that even though taxation is in fact theft, the human race has not yet devised a proper method of sustaining a civilization without taxation, and that some socialism will always exist, some collectivism will always exist, and in that we should strive to manage this, along with our capitalistic tendencies, since we cannot eradicate them. Now, if you believe that you can put forward a sustainable path towards the elimination of the state, which I'm all for, granted it isn't likely to devolve into a brief period of anarchy and power struggle that will end up right back where we started, by all means, post your ideas in the comments section. Perhaps you can sway me, or perhaps not. But this is my current analysis of the situation as I'm seeing it. Thanks for listening.